Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today I'm joined by a writer, historian, adventurer, chef, painter, and illustrator. She's the author of a sprawling graphic memoir that covers nearly a century of Chinese history, seen through the lens of three generations of women. It's a story of her own family, of survival and madness and love. It's called Feeding Ghosts. Tessa Hulls, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So Tessa, let's talk about Feeding Ghosts. Early in the book, you give some hints about the title. There's a quote, you say, "In Chinese culture, there is a concept of hungry ghosts, where the spirits of people who did not accomplish what they needed to on Earth are doomed to eternally roam the planet with an insatiable appetite, trying to quell a starvation with no bottom."
Yeah, in my family, that concept of hungry ghosts was pretty literal. I grew up with my grandmother, Sun Yi, living in my nuclear family, and she had been a journalist in China, writing for pro-nationalist newspapers before the communists came to power. So once the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, she found herself on the wrong side of history and was put through Maoist-era thought reform and essentially was subjected to 8 years of surveillance and forced to write false confessions such that it broke her mind. And so she and my mom eventually fled to Hong Kong and came to the U.S. So by the time I came around, she had been living within her own madness for decades. So I had a pretty literal hungry ghost in the form of my grandmother living in my nuclear family.
There wasn't much talk in your family. Obviously, you had your grandmother in the household and you dealt with her on a daily basis, but there wasn't much talk about this backstory. You said, my grandma lived with us, but as a child, I only knew three facts about her. One, she was from China. Two, she had once been a journalist, a famous author who wrote a best-selling memoir. Three, long ago, something happened and she lost her mind. And it was only around the time that you turned 30 in 2015 that you really started digging into the story.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency for people who have experienced something firsthand to assume that everyone else has the same context that they do. And so for my mom, because she'd had a front row seat to what was happening in China and then my grandmother's collapse in Hong Kong, I don't think she really understood that for me, it was a locked box. And I kind of only saw the aftermath, not the accident that caused it. And I knew on some level that eventually I would have to tackle this story. But I think I also had a pretty good idea of how hard that was going to be and how much it was going to take. And I spent my 20s really running away. But in doing this book, I kind of came to reframe that and instead now see that I was gaining a strong enough foundation to be able to give a decade of my life to telling the story and not being consumed by it.
And it didn't help that there was a language barrier. Your grandmother had limited English, and you were never introduced to any of the Chinese languages that are difficult to learn. They're tonal, for one thing.
Yeah, I did try and learn in adulthood, and I can speak a little bit. But basically, within my family, my mom and grandma spoke Shanghainese, and we were in a town of 350, so there were literally no Asians I wasn't related to. So I made the choice to study Mandarin, because if you're learning in the U.S., it's basically you're learning Mandarin and you're learning Cantonese. And so my mom, as a polyglot, she speaks Shanghainese, Cantonese. She can understand Suzhou dialect and she can understand Mandarin, but not speak it. And so when for this book, I went and met my family for the first time, there actually wasn't a shared dialect that everyone could both speak and understand. And so my 95-year-old great uncle was still sharp enough to be switching dialects so that we could all kind of at least mostly follow what was going on.
Yeah, you talk about going to China to meet your extended family, and they're off in the Suzhou area of China. And this was a trip you took with your mom. And that trip really changed your relationship with your mom as well as with your extended family.
I think growing up, my mom really didn't understand that there was no way for me to see where she had come from, and that a lot of the things that in context made a huge amount of sense seemed very out of place and jarring against a backdrop of rural America. And so the process of traveling to Hong Kong and China with my mother, it was really the first glimpse I'd ever had into who she was, sort of before my grandmother's breakdown had forced her to assume a caretaking role that she would hold for the rest of her life. And there is this one moment that I really strongly remember of, we were walking down the street and my mom saw a sugarcane vendor and she just tugged on my arm and she said, "Oh, Tessa, look, it's a sugarcane vendor. I used to love eating sugarcane." And just seeing my mom, these little flashes of her as an unguarded child, it really helped me feel so much more compassion for the sadness of what had happened to her and how much her own mother's trauma had really closed the window of possibility on what her own life could hold.
Well, you and your mom had very different approaches to expressing your emotions. And you refer to these two very different sides of your mother. You talk about her ghost twin.
It's a pretty common response for people who have gone through something really traumatic to just deny that anything has damaged them. And I think my mom was forced to be so responsible by every possible metric, which, you know, she did taking care of her own mother starting from when she was 10 years old, but then also in immigrating to the US, starting a family, bringing her mom over. And along the way, I think my mom just became so good at rigidly succeeding at the cost of having a connection to her own pain. But she instead sort of created the second self to house all of those things that she didn't know how to process or touch. And I called that her ghost twin. And it really would be like watching this cold mask come down over my mother's face when she touched on something that she, for her own emotional survival, needed to not acknowledge was there.
Right. You mentioned your mom's trauma. I mean, she was a child escaping Maoist China during the Great Leap Forward with her mother heading to Hong Kong. Let's back up a little bit because the first part of the book helps set the scene with lots of history and family backstory. And you write about your grandparents having their first date in 1949 in Shanghai, something like, what, 3 days after the communists took over the city?
Kind of as it was happening. So the fall of Shanghai to the communists, it was the writing was on the wall. You know, the troops were coming in from further north and everyone sort of knew it was going to happen. And it was actually really anticlimactic on sort of the official takeover. And there are firsthand accounts of people kind of coming out of their houses and just seeing the People's Liberation Army politely sitting there, because there had been so much bloodshed previously that it actually just like kind of ended with a whimper, not a bang. So my mom was the result of my grandmother having a fling with a Swiss diplomat. And once she told him that she was pregnant, he never saw her again. And so that's an interesting point of my family story, is the intercession of this white man who disappeared still managed to have an extraordinarily strong downstream impact on pretty much everything that came to form my grandmother and my mother and my own life.
Yeah, and the story of feeding ghosts really centers on the women, because a lot of the male partners who are involved either go absent or they're just not totally invested.
Yeah, that was a question that when my editor and agent first read the outline that I'd written, they said, "Where are all the men?" And I just followed the thread of who ended up assuming responsibility. And so that negative space is really its own answer. And one of the most unexpected things to come from this research process was, because my unknown Swiss grandfather was a diplomat, and the Swiss, thank God, are very meticulous record keepers. So I was able to get a copy of his diplomatic dossier and learn that he also had attempted suicide and been committed to a mental institution. And through many degrees of sleuthing, I basically discovered that I have a whole half family in Switzerland and was able to make contact with them. And it turns out that my Swiss grandfather partially came to China because he was running away from another woman who he had impregnated and abandoned. And so it was really powerful and fascinating learning that my mom had an older half brother, and they actually met through this process and kind of bonded over the fact that they were both the result of this irresponsible, reckless man leaving a woman to clean up their mess.
And 8 years of drama follows this fling. Your grandmother, as you said, was a journalist. And the next 8 years were this incredible mixed bag for her because she had this child who was part foreigner, and that had its drawbacks and its benefits.
Yeah, the drawbacks were definitely while she was still in mainland China, and the benefits came later after they fled to Hong Kong because it put her closer to essentially the structures of colonial power and whiteness. But during the time that my mom and grandma were still in mainland China, you know, anything that was seen as disloyal to the mainland, anything that was seen as fraternizing with the enemy was incredibly politically dangerous. And so my mother's existence was basically a beacon of my grandmother's transgressive guilt because she had fraternized with foreigners. And part of the tragedy of that is my grandmother had to sever all ties with her extended family because she knew that those black marks would pull them down with her if she was associated with them.
And this was something you found out later from your extended family in Suzhou. We'll get back to that, but your grandmother finds a way into Hong Kong with your mom at 7 years old, and she writes this best-selling book that's kind of this scandalous tell-all. And you write that your grandmother was a deeply unreliable narrator.
It's really interesting because she was a journalist, and so she was deeply concerned with facts. And so my grandmother's memoir, which was titled 8 Years in Red Shanghai, Love, Starvation, Persecution. So, you know, she liked to be dramatic in her choice of language. But it was interesting because, you know, her life basically lined up with all of these major events in Chinese history, and she documented them to the day. And I was able to fact check all of that and have everything that she was saying confirmed by multiple other sources, other memoirs, other newspaper articles. And so what was interesting is that I think she was deeply trustworthy when it came to the historical facts. But the part where I think she took license was in how she portrayed herself as standing up to the Communist Party, because from everything that I've learned about that era, if she had really been talking back as much as she presents herself as having done, she would have been executed. And so I think that's where I have a little bit of skepticism towards the character she portrays herself as. And then additionally, my grandma wrote her book in this huge manic rush in only 3 months once she and my mom were in Hong Kong. And it was after that she had her first mental breakdown. And so looking back, it's very likely that that book was itself the beginning of this manifestation of her break from reality.
And her book, to some extent, was trying to correct this historical revisionism of the Great Leap Forward, which was, you know, a disaster in the 50s in China, but was twisted by Maoist era thought reform to be this this great triumph. So, you know, we see historical revisionism. It can be on the scale of a nation or a family.
Yeah, and I think that's really the point I was trying to make in Feeding Ghosts. And I talk about the only way I can describe what happened in my family is by coaching it in relationship of what was happening in mainland China, because they were really entwined. And I think about the idea of how fractals repeat the same shapes. And very much by telling this intimate story of my grandmother's break from reality, I am making that larger point about what essentially Maoist policies did to create a famine that, depending on what sources you believe, killed between 15 and 46 million people.
And none of us are immune to historical revisionism. I mean, here in the U.S., we've been fighting over our national mythology for generations.
Yeah, and that's where I think it's important to always try and provide the context. So, you know, I'm very much for the idea of replacing monuments, but I feel like we should just cast like a 1/8 model of what was there before, and then just have the whole line of everything that preceded it with, you know, this is who made it. Like this is the background of why this is something that in this time period we thought should be venerated. Because I think when you're seeing things as a singular event instead of a sequence, you just end up with this ping-ponging between extremes instead of looking at all history as being a really complex web whereby whoever is telling the story is charting a different course.
Now, just to show how much history was happening right around your grandma and your mom in these early days, they smuggled themselves into Hong Kong. And well, it's the early days of Hong Kong being this kind of colonial port that's still under British control. And at this time, they're finally coming to terms with mental health on a societal scale, not so much on a family scale. And so here's this first mental health facility in Hong Kong, Castle Peak Hospital. And it's founded right around the time that your mom and grandma show up in Hong Kong, and your grandma ends up becoming one of the first patients.
Yeah, I wish that I could have gone more deeply into Hong Kong's history as a colony, as a special administrative region, because it is so rich and so fascinating. Because it's a place that essentially has never had a sense of its own permanence, and there's nowhere else like it in the world. And I do think you're right that Hong Kong had to start paying more attention to mental health care in the 1950s, because it had kind of always been a sanctuary for people who were fleeing the turmoil of various historical regions and periods in mainland China. And so during the time that my family was leaving, they were part of a mass exodus. And so people coming into Hong Kong, they'd usually been separated from their families. They had gone through unspeakable trauma. And because family structures were severed, they couldn't be cared for in the home in the way that was traditional in Chinese society. And so suddenly having hundreds and hundreds of thousands of new refugees and immigrants who were really psychologically damaged, there was new infrastructure that had to be built to take care of them. And my grandma was one of probably the first patients in Castle Peak.
And in this great stroke of luck, your mom ends up in a boarding school at the age of what, 10?
Yeah, so my mom and grandma fled to Hong Kong right after my mom turned 7. And basically, once my grandmother wrote her book, it made her enough money that she could enroll my mom in this really prestigious boarding school, DGS, for 1 year. And part of my grandmother's mental breakdown was because her book ended up being pirated. She thought that she was going to be able to financially support herself, but instead, she basically got paid for the advance and then never got anything else. So she had her breakdown. And at that point, my mom had been in this colonial boarding school where she was being taught by British expats and shamed if she ever spoke Chinese. And there was no money, but she was already one of them. And so they took her on as a charity case and supported her for the rest of her education while her mother was institutionalized. And my mom made the choice to not tell anyone about her mother's situation, because there was so much stigma around mental illness. And so nobody knew. And my mom was sneaking out on the weekends to go visit her mom in the mental hospital.
So, in the book, you're honest about your own psychological struggles. And your mom was terrified at one point by the emerging talent that you had for writing and art. It seemed to maybe have echoes of your grandmother's experience.
My mom was terrified. Her narrative was that the reason her mother had had this breakdown was because she had been a writer, and the creative temperament comes with, you know, a higher than average incidence of mental illness, or at least this is the cultural narrative. And I push back on that idea a little bit. I do think that both mental illness and creativity are about having the sort of mind that is drawn to unusual frontiers. But I think for me, it's really the question of, is this a terrain that you're choosing to go to and navigate for your own purposes, or is it something that you become trapped in? And for my grandmother, she was very much trapped. Whereas for me, I think I was one of those kids where it was clear from day one that I was a writer and I was an artist, and that for better or for worse, that was not something I would ever be able to change. And so I'm my mom's only daughter. I do have an older brother, but I think because she had such an intense and damaged model of mother-daughter love, and then additionally, I had an overabundance of the creativity that she thought had broken her mother's mind. My mom really tried to preemptively save me from my own mind through a series of, let's say, increasingly more intrusive interventions, which was basically why I ran away from my family at the first moment I could, and then didn't come back until I was 30 when I started this book.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kanzer, and today we're talking with artist and writer Tessa Hulls. She's a painter, illustrator, and the author of the graphic memoir Feeding Ghosts, about family secrets, madness, and survival during the Maoist upheaval in China. So, Tessa, your art of choice is painting. Your artwork has been featured in a number of shows. You tend to use bright colors. In this book, you go into deep monochrome black and white.
It feels like a pretty apt metaphor for what the experience felt like. Yeah, this book, it was really challenging to have to work with something this heavy for this long. And initially, I did want to do the book in color, but a huge part of teaching myself to draw comics was needing to unlearn the visual vocabulary that I had as a painter. And so I knew that what I was doing was I was like rendering to richly in a way that was really visually cluttered and chaotic. And so I knew that I had to take color away from myself. which again, like that's what this book felt like. It felt like having to walk away from all the color in the world to carry this story. And I think ultimately, as I became more fluent in the comics medium, a lot of the techniques and visual language that I did have as a painter started to sneak back in. And that's why the book has basically no blank white anywhere. I've had a couple of people who have been reading it for interviews say that they had to use Post-its or colored pencils because there were no white spaces to write in.
Well, the art style is really effective for the material. It's got dark, atmospheric panels that reminded me of some classic comic artists like Julie Ducey, Christina Critter, Richard Sala, Charles Burns, maybe a little bit of Edward Gorey.
Oh, I love Edward Gorey. That was a huge, huge influence. And actually, I have a great anecdote about my favorite ever homophone miscommunication. Is a lot of my friends are scientists, and I had a friend who was giving a talk, and he asked me if I would illustrate it. And this is when I was working down in Antarctica, and so we were talking on like a landline, and he asked if I would do a series of illustrations about scientists who had died in gory lab deaths or like were otherwise killed by their science. So like Marie Curie and radiation poisoning, there was like a guy who died in a walk-in centrifuge, stuff like that. And so I heard the word gory and I thought he meant in the style of Edward Gorey, whereas like he was meaning violent. And so I delivered all these to him, and we realized this was the best miscommunication ever because I had drawn gory lab deaths in the style of Edward Gorey.
So, like very poetic Victorian style deaths.
Yeah, it was a blast to illustrate. And yeah, the Charles Burns definitely was a big influence. Black Hole, I think you can see that that's one of the books I stared at a lot when teaching myself to draw comics. Also, David B's Epileptic was a really big influence, which I really think that book should be part of the sort of broadly known, like top 10 canon. And for whatever reason, it just seems like people in the US aren't as aware of it.
Well, in keeping with your painterly talents, your main tool was a Japanese brush pen.
Yeah, I knew that I had to do this. Can't take being a painter entirely away from me. But again, it's not something that I had worked in until this project, but it felt like a way to have both precision and fluidity, which is, I think, a hallmark in everything that I do, is being a very tightly controlled maximalist.
Well, you did mention Antarctica, and you've traveled and worked all over the world from Alaska to Ghana to Antarctica, and Antarctica was where you taught yourself to draw comics. And I'm going to assume you can't bring quite as many art materials there.
Yeah, so the way that I for many years balanced the financial realities of being a working artist was by accidentally becoming a chef by way of playing college rugby. It's a long story. But I learned that you could take seasonal contracts as a cook. And so I was down at McMurdo Station working as a cook, and you work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, which doesn't leave a lot of free time. And your first year there, you're kind of at the bottom of the housing lottery. And so I lived in a room with five other people, and someone was always working night shifts, so the lights had to be off. And in order to work, I ended up making a little studio under my bed. And I wanted a way to really capture just the rich absurdities going on around me, and figured comics would be a really good way to capture some of the feel of just this wild, wild place. So yeah, that was my first foray into the medium.
Well, another way in which your painterly side expresses itself in this book, in Feeding Ghosts, is in the visual metaphors. You portray scenes with puppet shows, pinball machines, chess sets, water in its many forms.
Absolutely. I think that's why I chose to do this book as a graphic novel, is the way in which you can really subtly reinforce overarching points by having visual elements in the background that you're never completely spelling out for the reader. But I think the way in which I was trying to emphasize that there are all of these different layers, different patterns of movement, different sort of random ricochets that combine to form a story. There's a lot of visual elements that are basically saying that throughout. And then also because it was just such an incredibly depressing story to tell. Like, I couldn't change the source material. Like, I couldn't just pretend that it wasn't a story about like darkness and breaking minds. But what I did do sort of for my own sanity and emotional well-being while working on this is I had fun sneaking in references from my own childhood. So, you know, we've got the Royal Tenenbaums, the Little Mermaid, Rock'em Sock'em Robots, viewfinders, things like that, where if you look closely, I think you can definitely tell that I was a child born in the mid-80s. And I also think there's something to the way in which the early touch points of your childhood and adolescence do become the framework through which you see the world. And I think that's a hallmark of mine, regardless of what medium I'm working in, is I'm sort of known for having really unexpected metaphors or lenses that at first sound really absurd, but once you actually follow the whole point that I'm making, they're very intentional.
Right. You really play around with the tropes, with the metaphors. So when you break free of your family in your 20s and, you know, your character in the book heads out into the wilderness, you portray yourself in Sergio Leone style Western garb. But then you deconstruct that cowboy myth and you talk a bit about the history of the Mexican vaquero.
Yeah. So a huge question that I'm asking throughout the book is, what are the stories we tell about ourselves? And as somebody with immigrant parents, my dad's from England, I think it was really interesting growing up in a very, very small town with not American parents, and therefore seeing the constant points of tension between the family system I was raised in and the larger culture in which we existed. And growing up also on the West Coast, the frontier myth is so integral to the story America tells about who we are. And I think it's really easy to romanticize. And now we're having a really necessary national conversation about what does it mean when your founding myth erases the violence that was required for it to be true. And so the book is a simultaneous deconstruction of the entire notion of what it means to be a cowboy on sort of a cultural and country level, but also what it means individually, where I use that metaphor to talk about how I, like my mother and grandmother, had basically closed myself off from my own emotions in order to survive the weight of the story, and realizing that I was walking towards the same fractured inability to have close relationships that defined both of them.
Right. You quote the writer Karen Russell, "To be a true historian, you had to mourn amply and well."
Yeah, I talk about how the ghost tricked me because I was going to initially tell this story as a historian, and there were going to be no feelings. I was not going to be a character in it. And the ghost tricked me by redefining what I thought history was. And I think the process of learning the dry facts of this story really made me open up into a vulnerability that initially I really did not want to touch and didn't feel equipped to touch. But something about having to put myself in my mother and grandmother's shoes, it really allowed me to access that sadness on a somatic level.
I don't think the reader can really predict, as they're reading the book, the twists and turns it's going to take. You say, "As I chased the facts of my family's story across three continents, the answers I found began to shift the questions I needed to ask."
I think any memoir, if you've done your job, you will have to change the scope of what you thought you were doing. And to me, those are always my favorite works of art, the ones where you can see that whoever made it, regardless of what it is, was really willing to be loyal to the story above all else and allowed themselves to be diverted from what they thought they needed to do to what the story actually needed. And for me, in Feeding Ghosts, it really required this emotional softness and vulnerability that, if I had known at the outset that that was what I was doing, I probably would have continued to run for another decade.
You talk in the book about how you found refuge from the psychodrama of your family by diving into literature and looking for wisdom there, and that books inspired you to explore new frontiers in the real geographical world. You quote Herman Melville that you were tormented with an everlasting itch for things remote.
I've always been unusually literal, and so I had an older brother. He was a year and a half older, and so I remember just being like filled with jealousy when he learned to read before me. And so I think I demanded that I be taught to read shortly thereafter. And once I realized that letters could be strung together into words and sentences and paragraphs, and that books were entire worlds, I lost myself in them. And I was a kid who always had my face shoved in a book. I would stay in at recess to, hide under my desk and keep reading. And I think that's a really common thread. There's a wonderful book, The Child That Books Built by Frances Spufford, that talks about how if you happen to be born into a childhood where, for whatever reason, you don't feel you can have a home where you are, books are the things that will save you. And that, I think, is really what laid the groundwork for me to eventually make Feeding Ghosts, is I never thought of myself as a writer, and to this day don't necessarily think that being an author is an ambition I've ever held. But I was someone who, from the first moment possible, just lost myself in the rhythm and beauty and transportation of words. And I was reading, Jack London and Kerouac and Wallace Stegner and sort of all of these models of the cowboy, of you have your stoic, square-jawed man who goes off into the wilderness to find himself. And I was really drawn to that. And it wasn't until later, when I started turning a critical lens to kind of that whole like feral wilderness Western frontier canon, that I began to really think, well, what does it mean if the text that sort of became your foundational mythology left no room for someone like you to exist? And that, I think, really was a question that began to work itself under my skin. And so coming back to tell the story of Feeding Ghosts and face this fissure within my family, I think part of it was really looking at what is the duty that we owe the systems that created us? And for me, I think the choice to be a cowboy would be like a very male choice, to just walk away and say it's somebody else's thing to fix. And I think that's where being a woman and sort of telling the story of this repeated legacy of the women in my family picking up the pieces, this was a task I really felt I had to do, sort of in opposition to that cowboy myth.
So when you decided to dive into your family history, You went full bore. You didn't hold back. You had a translation made of your grandmother's book, which was still banned in China, and you brought a copy back to your extended family in Suzhou, along with your mom. You got a grant to go and do research in China, and you show up and you see this huge change in your mom as you meet up with your great auntie and great uncle and all these folks who your mom was just not allowed to communicate with for so long.
The process of this book stitching my family back together was really one of the most powerful things I have ever seen. And it was really the first time I had seen my mom outside of isolation. And it was the first time I had seen her just comfortably speaking her native language. Because for me, the only person I'd ever heard her speak Shanghainese with was my grandmother. And that was a relationship of caretaking and codependence. And so something about just my mom at a table with our family, just smiling and laughing and talking was revelatory.
This was, of course, after your grandmother died, and it became clear that it was not just your grandmother's problems with the communist government of China, but also your mom's and your own foreign ancestry.
Yeah, I think when the moment that I knew at some point I would really have to tackle this book, it happened when my grandmother died in 2012. And I was waiting with all this hopeful expectation that my mom would finally get to be free because she loved her mother deeply, but she spent her entire life taking care of her. And instead, nothing changed. And watching my mom basically go through all of the same rituals of anxiety, even though the object of them was gone, really made me see that this was a much broader story about the long legacy of generational trauma, and that I really hadn't understood what the damage in our family really meant.
And you quote Josie Sigler, you say, "You can't take too much credit for your strengths without thanking the wounds that engendered them."
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, when I decided to jump into this, I did it full bore because, for better or for worse, I am not a creature of half measures. And one of the things that I think professionally I've been praised for is being objective, never losing my cool, always focusing on the big picture. And for me, those were really survival techniques in childhood that coincidentally are very useful skills as a journalist. But I think the flip side of that was realizing that I didn't actually know how to put those things down, so that my immediate response to any emotional situation was to sort of step out of it and begin pretending I was a journalist with a notebook recording. And so this book, in a way, was my quest to destroy some of those very helpful survival tactics that had in turn become maybe their own kind of cage.
Well, I know you came to terms. I don't know if your mom ever came to terms with the ironic aside that you make in the book, which is, it's the great tragedy of immigrant parents. They open the door for us, and we betray them by walking through it and becoming children of a different world.
Well, I do think my mom and I, we kind of had to break all the structures down before we re could rebuild them. And it was really only the process of working on this book that I think allowed my mom and me to see just how deep the divides between us were. Because, my mom was the result of a colonial education in Hong Kong. And so she came out of that education speaking perfect, vaguely British accented Queen's English. And so because of having a lot of the conditioning and trappings of a colonial education, I think it was really easy for us to assume that we didn't have a language barrier. And the process of working on this book made us realize, oh, wow, we do not have the same baseline assumptions about really anything. And I think now, because my mom and I both have a much deeper understanding of the cultural rules that shaped us, we've arrived at a place where there is far less blame. I don't think there's any blame anymore. And we're able to to sort of talk through what's true for both of us and no longer try and attack or change the realities that exist for one another.
Well, I want to go back to the visual metaphors, and one of the big ones is that the characters that you and your mom and your grandmother, the characters in the book are connected so many times by ribs or branches or vines. What were you going for with that visual?
For better or for worse, I think being an artist means just being more porous to inputs than the average bear. And there's a line that Aldous Huxley said, I think it was in Heaven and Hell, and he talks about the mind as a reducing valve. And it's basically something that allows you to tune out most of the world so that's more manageable. And I think artists are just people who have pretty poorly functioning limiting valves. And so for me, it's like, that's just what the world looks like. I feel it in my chest. I feel it in my ribs. I sometimes have to follow tendrils of light. And for me, these things just aren't metaphor. It's the somatic reality of the world that I inhabit. And so me drawing those is just, it's me drawing the world in the same way that I might draw a coffee table.
You do talk about your journalistic background, but the chapter headings in Feeding Ghosts are inspired by poetry and literary references.
So those epigraphs, the book is structured into 11 different sections. And the way that I've always worked across disciplines is by getting some phrase of text lodged in my head. And then I have to make a body of work to understand what it means. And so something will spring fully formed as language, and then I will have to paint, or I'll have to sculpt, or I'll have to make a trail, because I basically let the story tell me what medium it needs to be. And so when I was doing the first written outline of Feeding Ghosts, it's while I was living alone in the woods for this wilderness writing residency. And those 11 epigraphs were basically the bones that became the skeletons of the structure. So those were the very first things that I built the entire story around. And you're right, they're from a mixed assortment of poetry, academic texts. Stayed away from song lyrics because of permissions complications. But yeah, they were really the marker points that served to define the whole thing.
Well, tell us about the Chinese word for writer.
Yeah, so late in the game, I learned that the Chinese word for writer is suojia, and that the two characters, the first one is to make, and the second one is the character for family or home. And so to be a writer is to literally make family or home. And I just thought that that was the most apt description for what I was trying to do. And I think my mom and grandma really tried to do the same thing, but they did so without reckoning with this fissure in their past. And so in the book, I talk about this idea of my family is a broken bone that was never set right. And so kind of everything after my grandmother's first breakdown was growing around something that had fractured and recovered poorly. And therefore, my job as a writer, as a zuojia, was to go back and re-break that fissure and then basically use this story to stitch that growth back together in a way that was healthy and whole.
So the creation of the book was a really long process, and you did not follow the traditional trajectory of creating a graphic novel.
I did not. I would say for, so I worked on it start to finish 9 years, and I would say 8 of those were actively making, and the last 4 was when it was just kind of a sprint to the finish line of producing it. And for the first half, I was still kind of working, doing seasonal remote contract work, taking seasons off. And I don't think I realized how much I needed that, both for my creative longevity and yeah, just to have a break until those went away. But there was never a point where when you're making a graphic novel, the first thing you do is you write out a script of the entire thing, and then you make thumbnails to get everything all in place, and then you do pencils to figure out exactly how it's going to look, and then inking is essentially just going over territory you've already covered. And I skipped all of those steps and went straight to inking, sometimes doing panels when I didn't know what would be the rest of the content on the page. And I think that's why the book is being seen as different than most of what's out there, is because I think I made it in a really unusual way, where instead of going sequentially, I made the whole book simultaneously, and therefore never really had any section of it that was just a process of autopilot.
Yeah, as I said before, it takes twists and turns. And you say that during the creation of the book, your narrator character started to hijack the story, and you refer to her or yourself as a rogue honey badger.
Yeah, she went feral. I've always thought about my creative process as being a relationship. And I would say prior to this book, it was a good relationship. We kind of had each other's backs. There was a lot of mutual autonomy, but also mutual support. And she's still kind of mad at me for the process of this book. But anyways, as I sort of began to really understand that I was making a book that was tackling the very question of whether history or objective truth could exist, I started to interject into the story in some unexpected ways, where my rogue honey badger narrator, she just like sometimes interrupts the narrative. She sometimes sticks her head out of a panel and moves the reader back in time. And she started to take a much more active role, which never would have happened if I had scripted out the whole thing first. And I think there was a point in this process where I sort of saw this beginning to happen, and I could have squashed that and said, no, this is getting too weird. And instead, I basically said, okay, if this is what we're doing, if it's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, as I say in the book. And so I just instead was like, all right, go for it. Do what you're going to do.
And I do have to mention the tabletop brush holder that shows up when your narrator character is portrayed.
Yes, to denote to the reader that we are in my studio, I do have two paintbrush dinosaurs. One is a brontosaurus, one is a triceratops. Their names are Norbert and Winnie, and they do actually exist. They're physical objects. And yeah, that was like a fun little Easter egg for me to draw. Because, you know, there's like, I'm drawing about mass beheadings and people dying of starvation. And sometimes I just really wanted to draw dinosaurs instead. And that was a way to allow myself to do that.
So what's next for you?
As for what's next, I'm really interested in fusing my creative and wilderness lives. And I think what was so hard for me about making this book is it really took me out of engagement with the world for many, many years. And I am somebody who's very experiential. I like to be with other people. I like to be in the field. And I also want to work in a way where what I'm doing is of service. And what I want to do is become an embedded artist working with scientists who are doing field research around climate change and ecological resilience. And I basically want to pair with them for multiple years to be able to be their communication arm to talk about what they're doing and why it's important. Because I love scientists, but they are very, very bad at communicating with the broader world. And I essentially want to jump in as a comics journalist to shadow them and help be that bridge.
Right. You've spent time at long-term ecological research sites. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, okay. So I haven't necessarily spent time at those yet. That's a consortium that I'm hoping to become more a part of. But my experience working down in McMurdo, one of my favorite things there is twice a week, you could go hear science lectures. And so there was one where it was kind of for a general audience in the galley, but then there was another one held in the actual science building where you could just hear people talk like in all of their dorky splendor about what they're actually doing down there. And so there are these things called long-term ecological research centers, where basically they're field camps in remote places doing hands-on work. And I have found my way to some of them as support staff, but scientists get to go do all sorts of amazing things in really remote places most people never see. And there's a lot of interest right now in bringing artists more into this process to try and find different ways to make people care about the ecological disaster that that is already beginning.
And closer to home, you've done solo shows at various museums. You've written about the vanished Chinatowns of Santa Cruz County.
Yeah, a lot of what I do, and I'm grateful for the fact that I've like become the speed dial of somebody's like, gosh, who do we know who wants to spend an entire season researching some sort of like horrible racist Asian American history and then make it digestible for a general audience. So I've done that a couple of times. I did that down in Santa Cruz with these destroyed Chinatowns, which were basically lost to various forms of racism when the land became more valuable because of the railroad coming through, and they were lost to flood, to fire, to other things like that. And then recently in Seattle, I just closed a show called Nobody Lives Here, which was looking at what was destroyed and displaced when the I-5 freeway was run through Chinatown in the 1960s. And so, as part of that, the museum let me hijack the direction of the show and instead make it a survey about 150 years of Seattle infrastructure projects displacing indigenous and immigrant communities.
Wow.
You
Well,
see why sometimes I just want to draw dinosaurs.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kanzer, and my guest today has been Tessa Hulls. She's the author of the graphic memoir Feeding Ghosts, which tells a turbulent story of Chinese history through the eyes of three generations of women. Tessa, it's been great talking with you today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
TessaHulls.com, or they can follow me on Instagram at Tessa Hulls. I'm glad to have a phonetic but unique last name.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.